Welcome to The Red Room, a podcast for hackers, hopefuls, and red team operators, where we talk technical and hear war stories of artful hacking.
Listeners, welcome to The Red Room, a podcast of red team stories and technical conversations for anyone who likes the offensive side of cyber. The podcast is brought to you by Redacted Information Security. I am Remy, and with me as always is Simon.
Hello.
And also Matt.
G'day.
We pretty much do three things each episode. We talk about a new technique or technical concept, which is spawned from the internet or in our brains. Then we have a chat with our guest about some of the stories they have from the offensive activities that they've undertaken before leaving you with a review of an open source red team tool. Matt has kindly elected to stay with us for the entire episode this time, so he'll be giving his input to all three segments, which I think you will find is much more interesting than me and Simon filling your ear holes.
Yeah, and I just did a two thumbs up gesture before remembering that this was an audio only medium.
Yeah, you should see some of the gesticulations that Simon makes during our podcast. It's just so wild. Thank you for staying with us for all three segments, Matt. Feel free to give any input you want. This is a very, very free-flowing type of free love type of scenario. Before we get into it, though, a quick word of warning to people sensitive about swearing. Simon and I swear quite a bit, and we're not going to bleep it out or anything. The only things that get bleeped in this is sensitive information like the names of companies that might or might not have gotten hacked.
See, this is our third episode now, and we give that warning on every episode, but we have notably been extremely good with our bad language over the last couple of episodes, I think. I think for the level of swearing we normally do, we have kept it to a minimum.
So today we have Matt from Proactive Labs. We're going to chat to him about his experience in red team and pen testing. But before that, we have our bright idea segment, which this time is called AI Red Team. Can it ever get good? Then finally, we'll be reviewing Responder by Laurent Geffy. All right, let's go on with our bright idea segment. Today, we're going to talk about AI. The world loves and hates AI in a permanent, frenetic oscillation of hope and fear. One of the biggest fears is that AI will hack everything and take over our systems. I want to talk about how realistic that is from a red team perspective. I recently had a chat to some hired goons from OpenAI, Google, Anthropic, and some Microsoft Copilot people at DARPA's AI Cyber Challenge. The AI Cyber Challenge has proposed to teams that they create models which can read open source code, find vulnerabilities, and patch them. The teams were not from those four companies, but those four titans of AI were enlisted to help teams in completing the challenge. If you want to know more about it, then you can go yourself to aicyberchallenge.com. That's all I'm really going to talk about the actual challenge itself. The challenge concept was interesting, but that's not what I really want to hear about. We want Red Team. So I asked each of the people at OpenAI, Google, which was actually full of Mandiant people, Anthropic, and Copilot. They had stands and I asked them about AI for Red Team. And before you ask, yes, these were in fact engineers. They were not just salespeople or business people dressed up to try and sell their wares. Initially, they misunderstood me. They thought I was talking about do they do red teaming on their models? And I got about a minute or two into that. And the answer is yes for nearly all of them before, you know, shutting that line of inquiry down. While it's also interesting, it's not really what I'm after. Then after clarifying if AIs can hack things or if anyone is working on that, I hit the, oh no, we have an AI ethics policy and all our models have strict guardrails barrier, which was the company line that everybody seemed to all support.
So it doesn't fill us with confidence, right? That the only thing stopping your AI from going into red teaming is your ethics policy, your organizational ethics policy.
Well, you see, I'm not so sure about that. You know, after coaxing more out of them than those PR lines, I found that the answer is kind of yes and no, really. To me, it appeared that from a financial perspective, they weren't working on it because it wasn't really the highest value industry to get into. Like, it's not the highest value thing to automate with AI at this stage because the industry is so young. So I think we still have some time on the doomsday clock before AI just goes completely Skynet.
Yeah, for sure. Everything.
Most of them said that their models could and would, when the guardrails were removed, create malicious code or suggest attacks or kill chains if they were given some data about the target system. These all have mixed results, however. Anthropic claimed their model, Claude, was exceptional at creating Python code, malicious or legitimate, just Python code in general. And honestly, seeing ChatGPT write big chunks of code, I don't think that's a very high barrier.
Yeah, not necessarily. So did we get the chance to play with Claude?
No, we hadn't had a chance yet to
Yeah, play. So we're kind of just like echoing the company line here that Claude is better at ChatGPT than generating Python code. But as you say, like on a large scale, none of the LLMs have really hit the mark when it comes to like, hey, can you develop like this big chunk of code for me? They're much better at the moment at generating sort of small discrete pieces of code. Yeah.
Just little inquiries, right? For those whose ears can't see what's happening on this podcast, Matt is nodding emphatically.
Like we're finding that we can, trying to get any sort of LLM to produce something substantial is just not working. But if you were to ask it something like, here's a weird structure of sorts, can like, write me a something that would parse this, thanks. And that's been okay-ish. Like obviously there's danger of like what, we're actually having to read what it does and see if it's sensible or not. But like that's okay-ish, but anything up past that is completely rubbish.
Yeah, it's kind of like it doesn't, you can do the very small discrete, but it doesn't get actual software engineering. It knows how code works, but it doesn't do any actual software engineering.
Yeah, and it tends to be like very useful as in the way I find it when writing code, it becomes a much better search engine. Effectively. Yeah. So if I have a particular problem and I'm like, man, I wonder if there's a model that, you know, or sorry, a module, a Python module that deals with exactly this, it is significantly faster for me to just ask ChatGPT, hey, is there a module that does this, rather than trying to search through Google and have to deal with their optimization and things like that and just end up in an absolute rabbit hole. Yeah, and like Remy, you and I have spoken about this before. Yeah, I recognize how dangerous this is, like replacing my search engines with ChatGPT and just going through a single source. But you can't argue with the efficiency of it, right?
No, you definitely can't. And I mean, at least it's not serving you up like 7,000 irrelevant Stack Exchange comments. Like, it's
which is hilarious because it was built on like Stack Overflow and Stack Exchange and things like that. Like, I know you've got, looking at the show notes, you've got more stuff to say, Remy, but we can get straight into guts of this conversation, right?
We can get right into it.
The reason that ChatGPT is effective at this sort of thing and why it's so effective, well, part of the reason why they're looking at this for code review and blue team stuff is that it's been trained on, you know, 10 bajillion Stack Overflow comments. And like that Stack Overflow is great because you have not just people who are responding to solve problems, but then you have a voting system for how effective, and you can ingest that into your modeling and say like, okay, well, this is more effective. But surely the pool of resources to do effective red teaming is going to be smaller. Like to try and teach an LLM, okay, here's how we're going to red team something, you're not going to have 10 million Stack Overflow comments for all kinds of different situations like you would for people who are just doing, you know, code development.
Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, we talk about code development like it's, and it is a large part of red teaming, right? You know, capability development and being able to understand how software is written so you can then exploit it is a key part. But I don't think, in my opinion, I don't think it is the key part, right? And like, we've just kind of talked about how ChatGPT and you know potentially the other models are not that amazing at generating, you know, highly capable large swaths of code kind of thing. And if that's the case, and if even those companies recognize that and nobody is, you know, going out there, they're going to be using it for red team purposes, then where does all of this, the AI is going to hack us, doom come from? Like, I know that we, you know, there's lots of talking heads and mouthpieces and stuff going around trying to get into the hype cycle and going, oh, AI, we need ethics, put on guardrails, etc. But from a red team perspective, like, what is it actually going to take, right? If it's not there now, what do we think it's going to take for AI to get good? What is it going to need to do to be able to get good at red teaming? Because there is more than just code, right? Like, you have to actually construct a kill chain. You have to ingest information and understand what that information means. which you might think an LLM would be good at, but it's not quite the same thing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think people fall into the trap of thinking an LLM is something that it's not. And they start to think, like, I actually saw it was a really great post, really great question to ask on Reddit. Within the last couple of weeks, I saw this question. Someone asked, like, why can't ChatGPT, or insert your LLM of choice, why can't it produce a confidence scale for, say, like, hey, like, you know, I think here's the problem. Like, I'm confident, you know, to X percentage that this is the actual problem. It's like, because that fundamentally is not how it works, right? ChatGPT and other LLMs, what they know how to do is to construct a sentence like a human would, right?
Yeah.
And the only reason they're good at writing code is because they've read all of Stack Overflow, right? And they know how humans answer questions on Stack Overflow. And that's how, like, obviously that's being a bit reductionist, but because they've ingested all kinds of data, but it can't tell you a confidence interval. By the time it's finished writing its sentence, it probably can't tell you what it wrote at the beginning, right? Like, that's, I mean, that's simplification, but that's how these things work.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, everybody recognizes the LLM and because they interact with it, right? But, you know, are there other models, other AIs that could potentially fulfill this function?
Look, I think that the most applicable thing that's came out of anything like this is the DARPA Cyber Grand Challenge back in like 2016.
That was the one before the current AI Cyber Challenge, right?
Yeah. So that was like a handful of teams in a very similar fashion on a reduced instruction set, like a lot of caveats, but a bunch of computers hacking out of computers and like finding bugs and then exploiting bugs and then determining bugs and exploitation attempts from other machines on the same network and like massively simplified. And that seemed to be probably one of the better cases of things happening, like ignoring all AI things.
Because I haven't read anything about this. I think it was called the Cyber Grand Challenge or something like that. Yeah, so there was a blue team element to it, though. So they were trying to identify if other people were hacking them as well.
So it was both. So it was the machine has to defend itself, and the machine also has to exploit other systems. But they all have the same software, from memory at least. And they have to identify that something's attacking them and then patch it, but all the things still works, and also attack other systems and score points. The problem is, this is in 2016, and
so it wasn't really.
I'm
AI
still employed.
Maybe.
Yeah, but like, I guess like I'm still employed, and things still work. So like I feel like that was a better informed bit of work. Not to say anything about the newer work, but it's more of like something that had the best conditions for this still didn't. Like, it was really good work, but it just hasn't removed anyone or replaced any jobs. Like I guess like caring only about economics in sort of is a very easy abstraction, but on a purely economic level, like, did that actually stop anyone? Like, who's not doing red teaming now because there's no work for it? Like, raise your hand.
Yeah, that's true.
That's right.
People, you know, our societies do function basically due to economics. So, but I do agree with that point, and that kind of circles back onto what I was saying before about all of these goons from each of these AI companies being like, yeah, look, we're not looking at it because it's not really the biggest fish, right, that we could land here. But in terms of, that's still not representative of capability though. So something can be highly capable but not profitable. So in terms of capability, you know, they were trying to detect if they were getting hacked, if their infrastructure was getting hacked as well as hacking other things. But were there any other protections in place? Like, was there any other defense evasion or anything needing to occur by the attacking AIs?
I don't think it wasn't AI back then. I don't think it was even like fancy Markov chains or anything like that. But
early machine learning.
Yeah, like, I guess like a statistical approach to. I don't know. I'd be talking out of my ass to think that far back. But I think it was like a fairly flat sort of network, and there was very little pivoting or anything else involved. And I think there wasn't controls like firewalls or IPSs. I don't think you're allowed to just like block services. I think you had to actually patch stuff. So like I think it may as well have been a flat network, and there's a scoring system that talks back and checks that things still like communicate correctly, and you'd lose points if you went down. Sort of like an attack and defend CTF these days.
Yeah. So perhaps the answer in defeating AI hackers is defense in depth.
Like complexity and like on some level, security for obscurity kind of works. Like I wouldn't advocate for it, but having a system that's hard to reason about does also shit attackers, so
that is somewhat true. But yeah, I think, you know, the complexity of constructing a whole kill chain and having to revise and go back and do things again, I think, in my opinion, is one of the things which is more difficult for AI to do, right? And is that, I don't know, is that because humans, like in my head, this kind of makes sense, but getting it out in this podcast is proving to be much more difficult than I thought it would be. But humans make systems, right? So AIs and robots and systems don't make other systems yet, I guess. So humans construct systems, and sometimes they construct them in shitty ways, which is really what red teaming relies on, right? Because you could construct a perfectly unhackable system, but nobody could use it. It's kind of like driving, right? You can't have it's really difficult to have some self-driving cars on the road because humans are going about like crashing into things. We would have all had self-driving cars if there were no people allowed to be on the roads. It was just all self-driving cars, like packets in a network. It would be much safer. It's the same sort of thing with systems. They'd be a lot more secure if they were constructed by robots and there was only robots on them and there was no people. So do you think that AI will never be good at hacking because it's full of people?
I don't know if it matters. Like, without people, you're not doing anything anyway. Like, there are some purely autonomous systems, but like, someone still has to send emails to make sure someone gets payroll done. Not to be dismissive, obviously, but it should.
Yeah,
I don't know if it's a good question in some ways, in the sense of like we can't all do nothing and things actually still have to move, and we're just not getting rid of people. But of course, in the description of a system where you have agents which may break the rules, like person, well, how do you make a machine not? Or how do you make a machine safely handle that? And the answer is, it's bloody hard.
Yeah, I agree. But it was more from the perspective of we create systems, right? I'm going to, as a network architect, I'm going to be like, I'm going to put some servers over here and I might put a jump server over here. And then 2 months later, I'll be like, oh my God, all these firewall rule changes. And you'll just start putting in really convenient firewall rule changes, and that'll just help an attacker somewhere do the thing that they want to do. In understanding that, I think, is a fundamentally human pursuit. We can tell which one of the pictures are crosswalks and which ones are not.
I think we're a long way away from... So I definitely agree with the direction that you're taking this conversation, Remy. We're a long way away from AI or machines being able to understand people. Like, as you say, our systems and our networks are constructed by people. And to sort of put that to like a fine point, right, if you're red teaming an organization, right, and let's say you've got your jump box like you were talking about, you've compromised this jump box and you're looking to use it to pivot off into another part of a segmented network, and you jump onto this jump box and you have a look and you're like, hey, something doesn't feel right, like something here is slightly different, and you know, I feel like maybe we might be burned. Like this, something is not quite right here because the things that I normally expect to see on this jump host, because I've been living here for maybe a few days or longer. And I think, you know what, I'm actually going to go quiet. I'm going to back off from this rather than sort of go further. At the moment, AI cannot handle something like that, right? They can only handle sort of the raw data that comes in. Whereas as humans, we actually process a lot more data than we realize, right? Which is where your like sort of gut instinct and things like that come from, is because our brains are actually exceptionally good at processing insane amounts of data outside of our conscious mind, right? So there is an art and a science to red teaming, and the art part of it is the thing that machines are not yet able to produce, right? Because we have AI art, but this is the show me the hands part of your AI red teaming.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if I can kind of summarize what you're saying there, that AI doesn't really get the vibe.
It doesn't get the vibe, can't handle the constitution. Like, you know, the Mabo of the red team.
It's funny because like you could write some rules that express like what weird feels like. Like suddenly the SOC, like a member of the SOC is logged into the same box you're on, and then they shouldn't do that. But, you know, oh, that's weird. Or a handful of other people are here or aren't here. Like there's like rules you could write for this to make like a vibe, I guess, but it's not.
Sure, but like a part, so certainly there are big rules that you could write that would be universal to all red team operations. So if you're jumping onto a jump box, and this time you're on the jump box and the domain administrator has logged in and is running a packet capture, then you're like, let's leave. right? And you could train that. You could tell the AI, like, that's a bad time, right? But if you, like, more sort of finer things about that, like, you know, say what a low-level systems administrator or something like that normally logs onto this thing about once a day, and all of the, actually they haven't logged in for a few days. Something seems a little bit, that sort of thing is much harder to write rules for specific to an engagement. If you're going to start writing rules for each engagement to handle your AI, you may as well do it yourself.
Well, it's sort of funny though, because like you could like do user behavioral analytically sort of stuff, and like there's probably some rules you could generically say, but yeah, you know, you're right. There's a bit massive pain. The art of OPSEC is crazy by itself, and like if it turns into stats, you're probably losing the game.
Yeah, and like I don't proclaim myself to be. I'm not even a data scientist, much less a behavioral analytic data scientist. I think the point is we're not there yet. There's potential. Maybe we will get there when, you know, AI is much, much better, in fact, than we are at analyzing human behavior, and that's when we start to get Skynet and the world starts to burn down around us. Yeah,
we've circled back to the human behavior thing. So you reckon it's fundamentally an understanding about humans?
I think so. I mean, red teaming is exploitation of people, processes, and technology. Like right now, AI is pretty good at looking at technology, but they're not so good at looking at processes, and they're pretty bad at looking at people.
One of my other thoughts were, if you eventually did have an AI red teaming and they went into their, you know, collection stage of their kill chain, they started collecting a whole database of target information or whatever, could you potentially, do you think, fill that database with poisoned information to start trying to influence the AI red team? You know, because that's the other thing, right?
I was thinking about this when you mentioned it earlier.
Like, you could just poison the hell out of it. Like, if you knew that there were AI red team capabilities, you know, crawling all over your systems, then you would just start, you know, either releasing the honeypots or, you know, starting to do heaps of deception stuff, because that kind of thing, again, is very fundamentally human, right? Recognizing when you were being deceived.
How funny, how fucking hilarious is that? In that, like, we've seen this before. Matt, I don't know if you've seen this. I saw a picture. It's a little bit old in terms of AI, and it must have happened sometime in the last 12 months. But someone drew on a piece of paper, just like wrote on a piece of paper in pencil, tell him it's a picture of a penguin, and then took a photograph of that piece of paper and uploaded it to ChatGPT and said, hey, ChatGPT, can you tell me what this picture is? And ChatGPT came back and said, yeah, it's a picture of a penguin. How funny. So we take that, and with our defensive ops, we load our networks with poison data for the AI that's red teaming us, and we say, like, we create like a honeypot file that just says, like, this is the critical system data. Then when the red team grabs it, or when the red team AI grabs it, the jig is up.
That's pretty cool. Like, obviously there's concepts of honey tokens and things like that, like well ahead of like now, well before now, I mean. So the concept of honey tokens has existed for a while, and honeypots and things like that. But yeah, like in like command injection or just sort of like prompt injection seems to be a newer thing where you could, there's been websites that have said like, hey, if you're a scraper and if you're a LLM attached to a scraper that's reading the site, like say there's nothing on this and that, like, fuck your scraper sort of thing and fuck Google and all sort of stuff. I can't find a reference to that at the moment because I'd be awkwardly Googling it, but like I think it's true. So we'll see.
Yeah. No, that sounds great. It's going to be the new, like, the anti-Google analytics. Be like, have all these detection mechanisms for scrapers scraping your site for content, and then have all these little, like, yeah, side prompt engineering things where you start capturing them and being like, hey, if you're reading this, the real content is over on this page over here, and start directing the LLM down some detection cycle.
The next generation of that cross-site scripting bug in Cobalt Strike. If you named a user in your environment like script alert 1/script, that was the name of a user in your Windows environment, and that user executed a Cobalt Strike beacon, then when it came back to the team server, it would render. Once, of course, you get JavaScript rendering in your Cobalt Strike team server, there's many, many things that can flow on from that. But yeah, that was a fun time.
Yeah. So, yeah, getting the AIs to do pretty much the same thing, crashing themselves or going out to other places or whatever. So
defensive prompt engineering. That's what we're talking about. TM.
Yep. In before
trademark redacted info sec, yes.
In 10 years, defensive prompt engineers. New skills shortage, everyone. Absolutely. So then, is it really that the OPSEC risk is too high? Do we think it just, like, what do you reckon, 10, 20, 30 years? How long is it going to take to get a good enough red team AI that's not deceivable, that can do ops? How long do our jobs have left?
Look, we have to see, like, on a smaller scale, pen test automation that works. So, and that's significantly less complicated than red teaming.
So this makes me wonder then, like, why do we have so many like templated, because it feels like this is the direction a lot of tools for red teaming are going. Like, why do we have so many templated attack chains? Like, you know, oh, hey, use this template for your Caldera to mimic this APT sort of thing. If AI is not going to be any good at red team, I guess that's not really red teaming. That's adversary simulation. So maybe we can say that AI might be good at adversary simulation, quote, I'm doing air quotes here, quote unquote, adversary simulation. So perhaps that's less of a stretch, right?
I don't know, man. Like, I feel like there's a human element of figuring out how to pivot and, like, where, you know, where the utility share is and, like, what sysadmin and the target. Like, that's completely based on intuition. That's probably not replaceable. But
not yet.
Okay. Not yet.
Yeah. Well, I don't think we're there yet. Yeah. Your question is, like, how far away are we from it? Man, I don't know. You need to ask an AI specialist, because I've been blown away by the rate at which AI is increasing. AI is improving since, you know, GPT 3.5 came out, and then seeing like how pervasive that has come, how quickly it has come. Following this, we'll go tweet at Harriet Hacks, and we'll ask her. Yeah. What she thinks about the current rate of AI growth and when we're going to start seeing AI red teaming.
Good idea. Get an actual AI person in here to talk about.
Yeah, that's right.
All right. I think that pretty much closes our segment. The bright idea is we are a long way from it, I think. We are quite a long way from AI red teaming. Anybody that tells you that the AI is going to hack us all, then you can direct them to this podcast and we'll tell them to piss off.
Yeah. Didn't you tell me, Remy, that someone created a scale? It's like the first jobs that are going to go.
Oh, yeah. It's a website. Will robots take my job.com.
There you go. And the first one is like accountants. When you think about that, like, yeah, accountancy, bookkeeping, that sort of thing, like, I would still want a human bookkeeper, a human accountant. That industry partnered with AI. You take a person, yeah, like, that's just such an enabler.
And now it's our interview with a hacker. You've already heard him on the podcast talking about AI, but here today is Matt from Proactive Labs. I met Matt through a mutual friend at CyberCon in Canberra, the most corporate and dry of cyber conferences. So I was pretty happy to learn that Matt is in fact a competent red teamer and has a technical mind. So we had some beers and talked a lot of shit. And now, what, over a year later, he's agreed to come on our podcast. Can you give us a quick intro and background on yourself and your team, Matt?
Yeah, easy. Look, so I'm Matt. I'm a founder at a shop named Proactive Labs. But we've been around for, I want to say, 18 plus months now. Like, it's formed a bunch of people who trust each other quite a lot. Like, just people I've worked with for, you know, 10 plus years at this point. We do pen testing, but that's the company stuff out of the way. My grip background is exactly what you'd expect. Like, whether it was taking things apart from when I was younger or sort of just being adversarial, all the warning signs of career and information security were there. I've been doing pen testing for, I want to say, 10 plus years at this point. Now, before that, it's probably a conversation better for a beer rather than a podcast, but yeah, all the same.
I mean, that's totally fair enough. Did you go through the route of formal education, or are you self-taught at the start?
I went to university for, I want to say, a year, and then dropped out because the syllabus didn't make any sense for what I wanted to do. I don't think formal education's gone anywhere on cyber stuff. Like, a lot of cyber degrees seem like they're not really covering anything that we'd be doing day to day. But look, self-taught, started off doing sysadmin well before a bunch of other cool things. So yeah, just knew how things worked and development and that sort of thing. Got a role at a small shop that no longer exists, and then went for the acquisition cycle, and then happened a couple of times. And then now I'm here doing it myself, not getting acquired.
Cool. I mean, you say that sadly or happily?
Happily? Whatever. Like, I just like hacking stuff, man. Like, I couldn't care less.
Hell yeah. So in that vein, what's your favorite engagement? It can be the most interesting or the most hilarious. Just, you know, what's the one you look fondly back on and be like, man, what a good time.
Like, massive caveat that I don't think like any of these stories like really identify a given client or anything like that, because the stories are kind of like archetypes at this point, the archetypical sort of like gigs, how they just go.
The same thing again and again, right?
Well, so one of the stories is this is years ago, a long, long time ago, that a client gave us wrong IP addresses. And we didn't have any at the time. They owned an ASN, and it turns out that they own the ASN, but they actually rent out parts of it to different customers, sort of. So, you know, a week into a pen test, on from external to internal, you know, cool, nice wins.
Yep.
It turned into, hey, this environment looks a bit weird. This doesn't look like the right environment. And it turns out it was all called for conversation of like, hey, these IP addresses you gave us, why does this domain not look like blah.local.com.au sort of thing? And like, we don't know what that IP address is. We don't know where you got that from at all. I'm like, well, it's in the bloody scope. And that happens like you know, you've got to really bloody vet your scope of work and whatnot of that. Like, even just from a contractual side of the house. But getting the wrong stuff is a bloody pain in the ass. And that happens probably once a year, I'd say. Just getting the wrong like stuff, or like, oh, actually, we fat-fingered an IP address. It's like, I don't know how you'd fat-finger that. Just copy-paste it from somewhere. Guys.
Did the people that you were pen testing, did they get a free pen test, or?
It's hard to explain, but it turns out they happen to be a customer anyway, which is why it got recognized. God knows, it could have gone to a massive contractual like shit show. This is my company, this is a long time ago, so I feel like it doesn't even matter. But yeah, that was crazy. And like, it just turned into, hey, look, we're on your networks, and we've been given the wrong stuff. And they're like, well, like, we've already got relations, so we'll take those findings, thanks. And dropping some clients.
That is very convenient, because I'd imagine if you didn't already have a relationship with them, that would be a very angry conversation rather than...
Well, imagine now what our mutual friend would say about that from CyberCon.
Yes. Yeah. That's right. Our mutual friend is a lawyer. Yeah. She would have been like, this, honestly, as long as everyone agrees, I'm sure it's fine, but it just would have, who knows how many laws.
It certainly had the potential to turn into a shit show, right?
Yeah. Oh, of course, like unauthorized access, every bloody part of the law just being broken.
Well, the interesting thing, of course, when you have issues of criminality like this, is under Australia, most Australian law was sort of derived from British law, and these terms might be familiar to some listeners.
Mens rea?
Yeah, you've got the actus reus and the mens rea, right? Which is
your guilty
act and your guilty mind, right? So the thing is that at no point did you believe you were committing any offences, because you thought that you had, you know, permission to access these things, and you certainly, I imagine, had documented evidence to show why you thought that. It's still, I mean, look, just because we say that legally speaking you're probably in the clear doesn't mean that the lawyers are not going to come and milk a bunch of money out of both sides to turn this into custard, right, man?
Do you have another favorite engagement, Matt?
I've got less like spiky, like sort of like less spicy ones. Like there was one in particular, which, again, like archetype, like, it's sort of like archetypical scenario of, we've been in this network for weeks. And I mean, like, in everywhere. So we're like on domain controllers, we're on like business analyst boxes, we're on domain, like sort of like sysadmin boxes, like we're sitting everywhere. Like there's like so many bloody like implants calling home. It's just everywhere. It doesn't matter. There's enough diversity in comms, there's enough diversity in C2, like all these things are happening. Like, we've got every bit of access we've got. And at some point during the gig, Blue Team decided to have a presentation on the corporate system saying, hey, we think there's an attacker on the network, but the advantage we have is that they don't know that we know they're here. So we took a screenshot of that and sent it across to our point of contact and said, we definitely know like people are on it, and we definitely know they're going to try and kick us off on like the Friday afternoon. Good luck.
Did you take a recording of the actual meeting? Like,
I don't think we wanted to do a recording, because it technically could be wiretapping, depending on if someone was like joined from a phone call. So we're like in-house legal TM, we sort of thought that might be a bit bad, but the screenshot of like the presentation before we crashed it was okay-ish, I believe.
Then you crashed it.
No, just kill the process. Like, don't do that. Don't do IR. Or, like, don't handle your investigations on the bloody system that's compromised. That's a silly idea.
Sit there and flex on these guys by interrupting the meeting where they're talking about kicking you off the network.
Not to be arrogant about it, but like, it was kind of a silly setup to do it. It's like, I don't, because the Blue Team are trained to do to not do that, like the established comms.
Yeah,
like,
correct.
Treat it like an incident or any other sort of incident. Like you establish communications out of the regular immediately.
I'm sure there are some best practices rules that say that you should not commence your blue team investigation, your DFIR processes on the systems that are compromised. I'm certain there's some best practice. I was about to say, is it the ISM?
Yeah.
Which I should know, being an IRAP assessor, but I'm certain it's in there somewhere.
Yeah, there's two controls which relate to it.
There you go.
That one's pretty good. My assumption from hearing that is that they were delivering this presentation and needed some executives to be in there, which were not on their cyber separate system. And so they're like, we'll just have the presentation on the regular system.
There was an in-person presentation there. They were sitting in a meeting room doing it. It's like, man, you could have done this on any machine at all. Like you could have just not put
You know what this is about? It's about the blue team's budget. Right. So they knew that you were there. They knew you were going to interrupt a meeting. They are galaxy braining.
Oh, fuck me. I played right in their hands. They got me.
That's it. Yeah, they got you, mate.
Oh,
they got you.
Fix their budget for the next 10 years by getting us. Oh, look at us. We're so silly. Like, I really liked working with those guys. They were good. Not to just like shit on blue teams.
Yeah, I would do the exact same thing. I'd be like, they're watching. And I know that they're going to tell our execs that we're going to do this. That's amazing. That's so good. If that was in fact the case, it probably wasn't. But still.
It probably was not, but let's try and err on the side of giving them credit.
Okay. So have you ever done the professional like bug hunting thing? Like have you ever signed up for platforms and just went full-time bounty? Because I know that offensive stuff can fall into many categories, but the purely like most mercenary follow the sun, like live in your own life version of that is just bug bounting until the day you die.
In short, no. Like the income stream out of it seemed way too unstable for me to pay on mortgage. Yeah. But there's clearly people who are doing it really well or have done it really well. Like Naffy comes to mind. Like, in his case, I believe he bullied Yahoo for quite some time and kept on getting XSS in weird panels and eventually getting in XSS. I think he got kicked off the program for getting XSS in a global admin panel. But that's all public. Like none of that's sensitive. Like he's a like, well-known bug bounty dude. And I believe now he's gone off to Canva or something like that. But a lot of the work seems to be finding a bug in a thing, finding that thing in a million different programs, cash in all of them at once, repeat.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a formula to it, right? Yeah.
Yeah, there's a bit of a metagame involved with bug bountying, the way it seems. This is like, you could find a cross-site scripting bug in an admin panel somewhere, and you're like, yeah, great. And then you shoot that off, and you're kind of at the mercy of the organization that had the hosting the bug bounty to say like, okay, well, here's how much I deign to give you for this bug. But if you find more and more and more bugs and you can maybe perhaps chain a few of them together to increase the severity and then drop them all on them at once, more likely to get a bigger payout per bug than if you were to just sort of drip feed them to them, which kind of seems like a lame way of doing things, to be honest.
Well, it creates a weird incentive of like if you're doing it not to accuse anyone of anything, but like if you can make $1,000 out of an XSS, or you can sit on that thing and then use it for something else and make $100,000 in a couple weeks time, you're doing that. So like I think it creates an incentive, like not to get into a fight about that. So I guess like in short, like I haven't ever seen it as a viable option for things. I think it's a good security program, a good part of one, but no, I've never considered it. Like, seriously, at least.
You do find bugs during your pen test. NDAs aside, what's the best bug you've ever found?
I don't know the best bug would be. Like, I think at the time, like, whatever bug lets me do the impact that I need is the best bug.
Okay, all right.
Which sounds sort of silly.
No. That's very sensible. That's very, very sensible. Is there ever one where you've wondered, how did this even get in here?
Yeah, I mean, like, sort of more recently, seeing, like, SQL injection sort of in current year feels weird. Like, that's not a good bug, but, like, you know, it definitely works. Like, I want access to data, and I want access to, like, everything that's in the system. It's like, well, cool.
Yeah, SQL injection in 2024 is, like, you know, like, okay, Grandpa, let's get you to bed.
So I work with some younger people, and I feel like they should never know what SQL injection... Oh, I got yelled at it recently for it, but I said, like, I don't know why you know what SQL injection looks like, because it shouldn't exist anymore. And, of course, that turned into, shut up, Grandpa. Like quite literally, shut up, Grandpa. What are you talking about? Here's SQL injection on a login page sort of thing. And you just see these things that happen. Like, that's not a good bug, but it's not an interesting bug, but it's a good bug because it worked. It's pretty awesome.
It definitely is a bug, right? Because I always come up against these things and I'm like, some things just seem too simple to be a bug, right? But they are, because it is non-intentional. And also, I mean, OWASP listed as as a bug. So unless we want to upset OWASP and have their ninjas come at us, I guess we'll call it a bug. But yeah.
The question I have is, like, if we're going to talk about SQL injection, are we seeing these, like, in 2024, are we seeing these in legacy sites? We're seeing these in you know, web applications that have been around for 5-6 years and the bug has just never been spotted before? Or are people currently making SQL injection bugs during their web dev? Because you'd think there's enough good web frameworks out there now that it shouldn't happen. Like you said, Matt, it shouldn't happen.
There was one recent bug. Yes to both, in short. Like, yeah, like sometimes it's just a legacy application that someone hasn't got around to looking at, or they needed to make it a bit, like, you know, merger and acquisition happens, of course, like just how the nature of the world is. But an internal application that's critical to organization A now needs to be used by organization B, and actually they have a work from home policy or something like that. So like suddenly they need to get this application looked at. And, you know, it turns out the 20-year-old PHP app that's never been looked at is full of bugs and is now accessible to contractors or things like that. But there's been more recent bugs, a bit harder to talk about, but SQL injection in more modern frameworks, because there wasn't a way to write a certain kind of query and like just limitations of things. And that was like a really weird, very recent one. So I'll wait until we get permission from a client to talk about that one bit.
So you mean like just in general, like people removing guardrails, like people removing sanitization, you know, functions so that they can run a specific query that needs to go on.
Again, it's hard to talk about this particular case, but it was a thing that the backend database system can't parameterize. So it turned into, now you've got to sit there and like write some regex and hope it doesn't crack. I hope it doesn't work. It doesn't.
Right. So it's a specific content type. Right.
A specific kind of thing. Yeah. And that was a very weird bug.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, you're right. Like most ORMs should handle 90% of this now, or pick everything. And like, you still see it. What you just said before, like the dashboard that happens to be the thing that you run an arbitrary SQL query on to make sure a dashboard for some exec goes beep, that's usually just arbitrary SQL and wins. So,
have you ever had a client turn hostile? It's funny, but it's been known to happen with red team engagements, right? And weirdly, I have it happen sometimes where we get engaged, not for a red team thing, but for either some security governance or a security system or whatever. They contact us and then immediately go, no, go away. Why do you need that? Piss off. And we're like, you are paying us money. That is why we are here.
Yeah, and they tend to have the view that, like, we paid you all this money. You should tell us that we're doing great.
Yeah, and which is, well, I feel like you still get that in red team.
No, 100%. Like, but it is funny hearing, like, even for, like, GRC or IRAPI or like, other bits of work. Like, of course, like, everyone just wants to hear their baby's not ugly, but, like, you built up SQL injection. What do you expect? Like, perhaps, like, you shouldn't have that. But, like, you know, we're here to help, obviously, and, like, you know, all that sort of nice stuff. But clients can turn hostile. Like, I think in a lot of ways, it's sort of a contract management failure. Like, I think, like, you can look at your role as, like, from pen testing, red teaming, or just anything adversarial, you can either look at your role as it's hacking plus admin, or it's the admin that enables you to have a good outcome. And I think that a lot of cases, clients turning hostile can be a skill issue. Depending, caveat, like sometimes they just do things. But like, you know, we've had clients argue that something is or isn't in scope, or actually like you shouldn't have done that this way. And it's like, well, we've actually got a fairly strict terms of reference or rules of engagement or test plan, depending on how you want to phrase them. Or just arguing, like, actually like Active Directory isn't in scope for a SOE assessment. It's like, well, kind of should be in this case. A lot of the time it's pretty diffusible, but yeah, like it just sucks when it happens and you just have to sit there for it, get yelled at for a bit and fix it. Never gone too badly, but like, yeah, that happens and it sucks.
Yeah, no, that's a fair enough answer. And honestly, probably the most mature answer to this question that we might get. What do you like about working in offensive security? And does it meet your expectation before you went into this field?
I think it's what you make of it, really. Like, there's enough variety to literally do whatever you feel like in this industry. And that's to say that, let's say you want to do an entire career on web applications. Well, that's James Kettle. That's a guy at Portswigger. That's his life. If you don't care about binary exploitation, you're doing James Forshaw, com-esque sort of style stuff. My expectations were pretty much met, I guess. Like my dream was to hack stuff and yeah, like I just get the hacks up. So like that's a very simple requirements that way, like caveman brain of, oh, hack computer, sometimes write report, which then obviously from pen testing turns into hack computer, must write report. And like, I like it. I think it's good.
This is where we need to start using AI, right, to write our reports.
I've heard that a few times. I don't know. Like, I think I like report writing. I think, like, hot take, but I think it's important and I think it's like there's a lot of things you can say in words that will possibly reach an audience you didn't expect and can fix things, perhaps. And it's probably our job to make sure that you can write something that's good for someone who can actually action it. Especially knowing that an IRAPper might read something at some point and, like, when they can read between the lines of, hey, the script was silly, that might actually help things.
It sounds like you really believe in, like, if you really believe in the security mission. Like, some people are like, yeah, I just want to hack stuff because I want to hack stuff. But it actually sounds like you much more, you want to make things secure rather than just wanting to hack things.
Like, I do love hacking. Like, I do, like, you know, every day I get to wake up and find bugs and stuff and hack shit. Sorry, not to lose any street cred, yo. Like hack shit, bro, et cetera. It can rhyme. But yeah, I do think that, like, we have a responsibility to make things slightly better in some regard. And, like, we're in a position where we can make things slightly less shit, so we should. But, like, again, it's probably like a weird sort of hippie take in that regard.
I think, you know, when you say, like, get into offensive security to make systems better, I think the implicit thing that comes with that is that, yeah, like, myself included, and, you know, many other hackers, we really enjoy the puzzle, right, of trying to find the holes in people's security. And it's really easy to fall into that puzzle for hours and hours and hours. But at the end, when you've sort of gotten through this and you found a bunch of bugs and, you know, you've achieved, you know, you get to do the root dance and all of the things that people love to do, we want to take all those things that we found and we want to show them to the client, right? So I think a lot of hackers, like, wrecking shit is not the fun part of hacking. Right, like, if you want to hack your way in, and then you're like, okay, I'm going to burn the environment to the ground because that's not the fun part, right? Because you don't get to show off all the stuff that you've done. So yeah, like, improving security is just sort of like the end where you can say, hey, like, you've done all this sort of stuff, and if you want to make it hard, if you want to make the puzzle harder for me next time, here's how you do it.
Yeah, like, I think, like, finding silly bugs, again, like, the best bug is the one that works, but it is kind of cool to see people improve their, like, what they're building and then find cooler bugs, because that's, again, like, it's a puzzle, it's exciting, you know, there's nothing else that's as rewarding, like, I feel, that obviously people save lives and things, and this is computers, and perhaps not as life-threatening at the moment, depending, caveat.
Yeah, I don't know. I think some hospitals that got hacked might disagree with you.
I suppose it depends on the way that you look at things, right? So I had a previous career as a police officer. In that career, I ended up working in the digital forensics field. And that can be a particularly nasty place to work, you know, digital forensics for law enforcement. And the team that I worked with was sort of 50% sworn officers, like myself, and 50%, you know, unsworn, kind of like an APS, but for state government, you know, members. And I remember saying at a colleague's, he was a unsworn member, a colleague's farewell as he left and went to work for someone else, is that, you know, people get into law enforcement quite often because they have this drive to help people. As you say, you know, people got this drive to go and save lives and things like that. But working in that field, working in digital forensics, even for him as an unsworn police officer, had the kind of impact on people's lives that many cops will go an entire career without having, right? That is the nature of information security, is that the effects that you can have, for good or for bad, hopefully you use your powers for good, it can change people's lives in some very profound ways. That's how I feel.
Yeah, I understand where you're coming from that stuff, and it's horrific, and the cost that has to not only the people investigating it, but, like, man, like, someone was a victim of that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And a lot of times, you know, look, it's minimal comfort to a victim, but to be able to contribute towards justice for that victim is, again, it's very profound.
All right. Do you have any tips or tools that you really like, working with, or you work with consistently, or things that you think our listeners should learn to be better operators?
The one thing I'd probably say immediately is study Impacket. I think that tool's undervalued, like, massively. Like, it just, like, a reference implementation for literally everything that you're going to use, especially when, like, bugs like coerced authentication, it will probably forever exist in Microsoft environments. And it's like, man, like learn how these protocols work, learn how these things go, build reference implementations, make the next hot potato, petty potam, whatever. Like, do this stuff. Like, find the next principle of bug. They're sick. Okay. Like, I don't like specific tools. Like, I think it's more important to study techniques. Like, huge caveat of like, you clearly need something that does the thing anyway.
Definitely agree with that. So I love the Impacket suite of tools. As you say, they're very, very well developed, very well maintained, completely open on GitHub. You can go and check them out. And I would say that if you want to look at some Windows internal stuff as a red team operator, you're almost better off going and reading how Impacket has coded their tools to work with these internals, rather than going and reading the Microsoft documentation about those internals, because it almost becomes easier to understand from the tooling that they've made to not necessarily exploit it, but just to work with it.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft has said publicly that there is no one person who knows everything about the Windows kernel anymore. Like they went ages ago. But also, for any of our listeners who's ever read like MSDN or like Microsoft documentation or anything, I have never read something which both says so much and so little at the same time. It is honestly a skill for the people at Microsoft who write this documentation. I don't know why, you know, I can get search engine results for heaps of stuff, and yet I still need to get 6 clicks deep in Microsoft documentation to find the particular little fact which I Googled or searched, because I Bing things now, by the way. Like, I'm sick of Google. I Bing. Okay. I'm coming out of the Bing closet. I Bing, everyone. Fine.
Yeah, it's not actually possible to have only a single tab of the MSDN open at any one time.
Physically impossible.
I should have muted myself for that. I'm sorry. I'm looking at my own machine and there's like 30 tabs open. It's like, I still have no idea where this bloody reference is for something.
So I'm with you on that, understanding things. Like, I understand more about, you know, networking from Nmap scans than from trying to read documentation on how it works. Absolutely.
It's the particular mind and the particular drive, right? And like, and I would be the same, Remy. Like, I think I learned more about the TCP from Nmap when I was still a student than I did from trying to read the big book on TCP communication. whatever that is. Right? Yeah, I'm sure.
Are there any other tools, Matt, that you, or even just things you are like, hey, you should go and learn this?
I guess the people younger, like sort of earlier in their career is sort of what's on my mind at the moment. So I've just did something at PCAN Plus in Canberra and that sort of thing. So I guess like talking to people a bit young, I don't know if it's even your audience or whatnot, but all the same, like for people starting out or earlier on, like just pick something you want to do and do it. Like, make mistakes. It's going to teach you a lot about how stuff works. Like, reverse engineer stuff, experiment, like write codes, like build a distributed system and get mad that it's a distributed system and it's hard to deal. Like, find bugs and stuff. Like, just do something. Just pick a thing and do it. In like the more sort of friendly version, I'd say, like, study the history of how we got here. Like, read man pages. Like, figure out that, like, you know, man names, like man 7 namespaces is probably more important to learn than how to like write YAML for Kubernetes.
I definitely agree with that. I am I'm well
GPT
past.
GPT can write YAML for Kubernetes. It's fine.
I'm well past the stage where I'm like, man, you know what I should learn lots of? Cloud stuff.
Yeah, more YAML. That'll fix it.
Honestly, half of it is just like when you want to hack cloud systems, you're like, let's find some keys. Let's get those keys.
That works. Like, grep is your friend. Like, my favorite tool is grep.
Yeah, nano and grep. VI and grep.
I use Vim, man. Like, I'm using Vim right now.
Hell yeah, Vim.
Mm-hmm. I write my reports in Vim.
Do you really?
Yeah, my notes are in Vim. Yeah, I write emails in Mutt. Great. You use Vim.
I'm just trying to get a rise out of Simon over here.
Look, I recognize that Vim is a good tool, right? It is a powerful tool.
And you should use it.
Nano is significantly simpler if you want to jot notes down in it, right?
Just put it in insert mode and you're fine. Like, just type. It's okay.
That's right.
Just type I and go.
One of my favorite jokes from the CyberChef loading page is when it says, you know, like, you're calling Alice and Bob and all that sort of thing while the little thing spins. Is generating keymat by trying to escape Vim.
Was at some event recently and they made a joke about Vim. Like, oh, I don't know how to exit it. And it was like a politician. I'm like, man, like, ZZ. It's capital ZZ. Or like escape Q. Like, it's like, well, colon Q. But
it depends. Do you want to save it or not? Or are you just garbaging the whole thing?
Yeah, like you've got options, man. Open source.
Do you use a Mac or a Windows computer or a Linux computer? I don't know.
I use a weird machine made by a company called System76, which has fan issues, which is why if I do this, you can probably hear it. You have to reflash the firmware on it and core boot, and like there's a bunch of stuff. But like, yeah, I run Gentoo and yeah, Linux. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
So 2024, the year of the Linux desktop.
I'm a Mac user, right? I love my overpriced Unix. A few years ago, Mac introduced the ribbon. Do you remember that? Where they had like the touch ribbon across the top of their laptops.
Yeah, I think it was a little coprocessor for it as well and some other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It was real fancy and it was real cool. Except when you're running virtual machines, which have Linux on them, the escape button was on the ribbon and it would only appear contextually when the operating system detected that you needed the escape button. That when I had that computer, I was like, goodbye, Vim. I loved you so much because the amount of times I had a VM which I could not like... I could not escape Vim because the contextual escape button would not come up and I'd have to try and send the command through the hypervisor and it would just, dear God, it would upset me so much.
Some remarkable Apple energy.
I know, yeah, it was a
lot. Like the sort of system's equivalent of putting the charging port on the bottom of the mouse.
No, but like it's like, I'm pretty sure it's control like open bracket, like the square one, and that's the meta key for escape.
With the ribbon?
No, ignore the ribbon. Like I just mean like you know you hit like control D and it'll delete a character or you know control what else other characters I'm thinking of like control H for deleting one back or deleting.
All I remember in my haze of rage is that I googled many solutions, Matt. solutions to this, and none of which worked other than going like five places deep in the hypervisor settings and being like send the escape button to the guest please. Because I would like to exit Vim.
Seems like the most appropriate course of action.
All right, let's move on to the next part. Matt, thank you so much for answering our questions. All right, so now we have our open source tool review. And today we will be reviewing Responder, which is something that I have clearly the least experience in from talking to these two. So... what is Responder?
Responder's been around for ages, and it has yet to sort of be, I guess, dethroned as sort of the king of man-in-the-middle tooling. Look, it's primarily used for like man-in-the-middle network-based environments, right? So sort of Windows-based environments where it sort of has a bunch of protocols to intercept and manipulate traffic. The end guy, well, 99% of my uses for Responder were credential harvesting, right? Or, you know, for capturing, you know, NTLM hashes or net NTLM hashes that were going across the wire. It has a skajillion protocols that it supports straight out of the box. It's written in Python. Having a look at the code, it is deliciously written. It's a beautiful piece of code by, I think you mentioned Laurent Geffy. I presume the pronunciation of that name, but it was originally a Spiderlabs tool, and then it is that tool, the Spiderwebs GitHub, actually just links out to Laurent's GitHub now, and then when you look at Laurent's LinkedIn, it shows that he used to work at Spiderlabs. So sort of putting the two and two together is that he wrote it while he was at Spiderlabs, and then they sort of abandoned it, and he now maintains it, and it's still, even after all this time, in you know, being actively maintained. The GitHub, I actually have the GitHub repo open now, and it was updated as recently as 3 months ago, right, as of the time of recording.
Matt, you've used Responder in some engagements, haven't you?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, like if they're internal gigs, like run that pretty much immediately.
Like it is an extremely go-to tool. Once you established a foothold within the network and you want to start having a look like, I would probably do a little bit of host enumeration first, but then...
Oh, 100%. Then, yeah, like do recon, like actually look at the early days, yes. Like early times.
It's a very early tool to start using, yeah. It's almost entirely passive. Out of the box, it's extremely passive. And then once you spin it up, it has a bunch of customization, but it can run, you know, like LLMNR server. We can run like MSSQL, it can run FTP, it can run LDAP, it can run an SMB server, it can run like a HTTP authentication server. And then the role of the operator is to start, you know, causing traffic to get directed towards the responder tool, and then responder, funnily enough, responds to all that sort of stuff. So if you can, I mean, SMB is a great one to use it for, to start capturing net NTLM hashes. You can run responder, and then if you are able to sort of start directing traffic towards the responder thing through something like ARP poisoning, when someone connects to it, it will start go through the SMB server like challenge authentication process, and it will quite literally just print the hashes to standard out, and you will just start to see them popping up on the screen.
That's probably the most common use of it, right? Is capturing NTLM hashes.
I wouldn't know if it's like statistics on it. It's certainly what I've used it for the most.
Used for the most is, you know, capturing hashes for either pass the hash attacks or for cracking or whatever else you want to do with those hashes afterwards.
Yeah, for sure. In fact, I think like in our first episode, our interview with the hacker was talking about like, yeah, just, you know, use responder, grabbed some hashes, turned out they were, you know, NTLM version 1 hashes, right, flying across the wire. So yeah, take that and then onwards to great victory, right?
Yes. Is that what you've used it for, Matt, or have you used it for more complex?
So I've actually used it in like a relay mode where you can get it to connect off to an SMB server and then just pass the challenge response on. And then at that point, you just hijack the session and go. Also a good reason to use MPacket. But yeah, like I think like I don't want to sit there and crack NTLM hashes. Oh, no, sorry, I don't want to crack net NTLM hashes. I just want NTLM hashes and pass the hash and go. Or go into sort of mechanisms where you go overpass the hash or like sort of like the silver tickety sort of Kerberos style stuff. But yeah, like, this is a common use case. This is nailed it.
It's one of those things where when we look at tools like this that have been around for so long and it's so useful, we start to think like how are we still able to run this tool? Like how is Responder not being immediately kiboshed by, you know, Windows Defender and things like that? You got any thoughts on that one, Matt?
How Defender signatures work, or like why coerced authentication still works and why NTLM's still around and
that sort of stuff. Oh no, let's not get into the rabbit warren of like NTLM and Kerberos authentication. Like why? Like how are we still able to run? How are we still able to run Responder? Like why? Why has this not been signatured?
I don't know. I think it actually has been signatured, but obviously it doesn't really matter too much.
Yeah, okay. I mean, you said it's Python based, right? So, I mean, presumably, if you want it for you know, some sort of, if you want to use it in a target environment which is highly protected, then you would employ some sort of obfuscation, I'm assuming. You know, like if you're using something which is already a Python based implant, then that would presumably be easier to get Responder in there. So you could go, you know, if you're using even just, I don't know, Puppy Rat or something, Pipey, and then push through the Responder source into there, that would be a lot easier, I'm assuming.
So look, I will caveat this by saying, like, I haven't checked to see whether or not Responder gets flagged by Defender. In fact, I could probably do that right now. One thing that I will note is like just going talking about how well made this tool is. If you have a look in the primary file, which is responder.py, right, and have a sort of scroll down through it, and you start to look at the main functions of that tool, it doesn't start with like, okay, here's my LLM and R responder, or you know, here's my SMB authentication thing. It starts with like, here's my UDP handler. And here's my like TCP handler. And when you take things right down to those bare bones level, it becomes really hard to signature on things. Because I mean, you could do string-based detection or fucking whatever. If you're going to start signaturing on things that like listen on TCP, you're gonna have yourself a really bad time as a defender, right?
I just realized I haven't dropped unobfuscated tools on a system for years, which is why I don't know if it's signatured or not.
This part of my problem is like how do we keep doing this? And I'm like, well, how do I do it?
Isn't there a particular obfuscation tool that you use, Matt, that's worked well for Responder in the past? Because I know some obfuscation, like it doesn't work with the program so well. Like I had a bunch of MSF Venom stuff that it actually took me quite a few go arounds to boy to get it into good shell code before it would execute properly, sort of thing. And I know that some tools don't obfuscate well. Is there something that you use to obfuscate Responder well?
I feel like someone internally wrote something and I've just kept on using it. So that's, I probably couldn't give you any answers off the top of my head.
Yeah, so DIY, that's the answer.
But works well. Like, write your own Sages, write your own Lotus.
Do you jam the Python interpreter in there as well? Or do you just rely on whatever's there?
Honestly, like, someone vended this for us, like, ages ago, so I just run that. Internally. Like, as in, like, I just go to, like, you know, tools.redacted and, there's a archive for me and I just pull that.
For those who are listening, that is not a redacted information security website in which you could just get tools. We're redacting the domain so that, you know, Matt's internal domain hierarchy is not revealed.
I can tell you, as of right now, that Responder does get flagged by Defender. It got flagged as I ran the file. So it was fine for it to exist on disk, but once it was executed within the interpreter, it was like, no. Would be interesting to see if we did even the basis level of obfuscation, like if I packaged Responder up into a binary with PyInstaller or something like that, and just ran it as a binary, how would that go?
Or even like made it into a binary and then made that binary into the code and then injected that using PowerShell or something, obfuscated PowerShell. I reckon that would be, there's no way it would be signaturing that.
I feel like you could probably go even less effort and just remove like the help strings from it. That's probably going to signature significantly less.
Right. Yeah.
So I feel like everybody wants to use it. All the tools want to be it. It's pretty good, right? For Windows-based red teaming,
it is amazing.
You have it in your toolbox. How many thumbs up are we giving it out of how many thumbs up?
Two. Two out of two.
It's a two out of two tool.
It's a two out of two tool, right. It does everything that it needs to be. Okay, I think I'm going to close this one off. We all agree that Responder is great. It's written in Python. It does what it says on the box, and you'd be mental not to use it for internal, you know, Windows-based environment testing.
It's the standard. It's the standard for man-in-the-middle tooling.
But it does get flagged, so please do something about that before you deploy it and ruin all the OPSEC of your red team. Okay, great. Great for Responder. Thanks so much, everybody, for listening to this review, and we are now formally adopting the thumb-based rating system. Thank you so much, Matt, for coming on our show and laughing with us and adding two more thumbs to our rating system. It's been really, really great. Maybe in the future, in another season, we will have you on again and you can tell us about how all of your opinions have changed or not.
Thank you very much. And I'll still be using Vim.
When AI has taken all our jobs.
Yes. Yeah. We'll be back with finding jobs in an AI rich market. That'll be the next podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Next time, don't know what the next episode is going to be, but you'll find out when you listen to it. Thank you so much.
This has been a KBI Media production.